Well, welcome, everybody. Here we are with another episode of the Palisades Podcast. I'm Steve Crone, and I'm here with a very special guest at a very special location. Our guest is probably one of our only guests who's ever been in the Village Studios before coming onto the Palisades Podcast. Village Studios is an iconic studio in West Los Angeles that has been the home of countless incredible rock and roll performances and recordings. And our guest is no stranger to Village Studios because of his history in rock and roll and other parts of his career, which we'll get into today. So welcome, John Taplin.
Good to be here, Steve.
It's my pleasure. It's an honor to have you here with us. And we're here to talk about your life, your career, your life in the Palisades, and your new memoir, The Magic Years, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. I've read a good portion of the book. I'm not quite finished, but it's a fascinating tale about a guy who grew up in the Northeast and was drawn to rock and roll at an early age. And so tell us a little bit about where you came from and how you got up to that stage where you got into rock and roll.
So I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, and at a fairly young age, 13, was sent away to boarding school in the Northeast, a school called Brooks in North Andover, Massachusetts. And I was a kind of, I came in a year later than most of the other students, so I was a little bit of an alienated kid who didn't really know how to navigate and felt very isolated in a lot of ways. And then in 1963, I happened to see on the TV a demonstration of young kids in Birmingham, Alabama, who were demonstrating against the racist policies. And the sheriff of Birmingham took it upon himself to unleash attack dogs, fire hoses, billy clubs, everything, and just beat the living daylights out of these teenagers.
That was Bull Connor, right?
Yeah, his name was Bull Connor. Yeah. And these were kids who were my age.
Yeah.
And it just outraged me. And so I joined an organization called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was run by John Lewis and Bob Moses, both of whom died in the last year. And I was also drawn to Bob Dylan because Bob Dylan was writing this music, blowing in the wind, the times they are changing. Bob Dylan had sung at the March on Washington, and Bob Dylan had gone down to Mississippi for SNCC to organize voter rights rallies when voting rights was very hard to do in Mississippi. And it was a dangerous gig, you know. A year after he was in Greenfield, Mississippi, three civil rights workers, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, were killed in the same town. So the movement and the music kind of forged something in my heart. And I started going on the weekends down to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where there was a little club called Club 47. And I saw Joan Baez, and I saw Dylan, and I saw the Jim Queskin Jug Band and the Paul Butterfield Blues Band and, just the Dave Van Ronk, all these incredible singers.
And I remember in reading your book, you saying that you weren't telling your parents what you were doing because you were supposed to be in school, not going down to coffee houses to hear
and
music.
I did have an aunt that lived in Boston, so I faked it that I was going to visit her. I began to find my love, which is what you always hope for,
You were lucky. You're a lucky guy.
You found a passion. And of course, my father had other ideas. My father wanted me to be a lawyer. He was an antitrust lawyer, and he wanted me to come, and I had followed him a lot of ways, and he wanted me to go to Princeton like he went to Princeton, and then he wanted me to go to Harvard Law School like he did, and then come home and join his firm. And so he had kind of planned my life out for me. And as I, you know, came at a certain point into 1965 on my way to Princeton, I went to the Newport Folk Festival. And that was a seminal event because Bob Dylan made a kind of quick decision to go play electric music at a folk festival.
And I remember he got booed.
And he got booed and basically set off the stage. Right. And it was shocking for Dylan, but it was also shocking for me because I idolized Dylan and I loved his electric music. You know, I loved Like a Rolling Stone, which was already on the radio. And these people were basically saying, no, you can't do that. You have to stay singing protest songs. And he didn't want to do that anymore. But I had gotten a backstage pass from a friend of my brother's, and I had been introduced to Dylan's manager, whose name was Albert Grossman. And he hired me to work for one of his smaller bands called the Jim Queston Jug Band. And so I got into the Grossman club, so to speak.
Uh-huh.
And so I was there backstage when Bob was booed off the stage and watched him trying to navigate that. And then I started working, once I got to Princeton, on weekends for the Queskin Jug Band as a road manager, because mostly the concerts in those days were a Friday college concert and a Saturday college concert. So I could do that on weekends and then get home to Princeton by Sunday night. And that became my life, beginning to get into that world of music.
So I have a question I've been wanting to ask for a long time, and you're as close as I'm ever going to get to Dylan. I remember later on in their careers, he and Joan Baez, I don't know if they had a falling out, but they kind of grew apart. And one of the things that I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, that she felt she wanted to continue with protest songs. She wanted to continue with the movement. And Dylan's response was sort of like, you know, I was never really a part of it, or that wasn't that important to me. And the songs are the songs. They're not deeper meanings to them. And that's the way I recall that discussion. Am I off?
No, it wasn't really that. I mean, I really think he genuinely believed when he wrote Masters of War in that, what he was saying about the military-industrial complex. Mm-hmm. I think he genuinely believed when he wrote the song about Emmett Till and all of that. But, you know, there's two kinds of artists. We all know that. There are artists that do the same thing for years and years and years and years and years and years, Cezanne, Aretha Franklin, you know. Uh-huh. And then there's artists like Picasso who start with one thing and pretty soon they're on to the next thing, and then they're on to the next thing. And that was certainly like the Beatles, you know. I worked with, sure, George Harrison, and certainly like Bob Dylan. He was constantly evolving what he wanted to do. Now, Joan Baez was more like the first. She did one thing, and she was also very politically involved. I mean, there's a scene in the book much later in 67. I was working for Judy Collins, and we went to the Big Sur Folk Festival, and Joan Baez had married David Harris, who was one of the premier protesters against the war. And,
right,
and David Harris had not only burned his draft card and said he wouldn't go, but he'd gotten indicted because he was a real spokesman.
Correct.
And he was about to go to prison. He wasn't going to flee to Canada. He wasn't doing anything. He was going to go to prison to protest the war. And she wanted everybody at the Big Sur Folk Festival to do something in solidarity with her husband. And I'll never forget David Crosby of Crosby, Stills, and Nash, you know, probably smoking a fairly large joint.
Not known for his political activism.
Yeah, saying, hey, I can do more on the outside, you know, with music than he can do on the inside with prison, which was kind of radical thing to say in that setting, but true, though.
Yeah.
You know, he went on 2 years later to write that song Ohio about the Kent State massacre, and that was became a number one song in the nation.
And a galvanizing song for all the young people.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is a tension there between politics and culture. And for Bob, he wanted to keep moving and keep growing. And so, of course, for me as a political being, I still kept, you know, I had friends in the anti-war movement. I still kept involved in that until 1968. And then in the spring of 68, I was still at Princeton. I was working for Bobby Kennedy, you know, his presidential run. And then in 2 months, Martin Luther King, my great hero, got killed. And then 2 months later, Bobby Kennedy got killed here in Los Angeles. And it was just like, oh, man, politics is just going to break your heart, you know. And so I just decided, well, I'm graduating from Princeton. I'm going to join the rock and roll circus. You know, I'm going to go to work full time for Bob Dylan. And by that time, my father had died. And so I didn't have the weight of, like, you have to do this on me.
It's interesting because a lot of people had the opposite response to the King and Bobby Kennedy assassinations. And they said, okay, I'm going to go out and I'm going to protest. I go to Chicago for the Democratic convention, get more activated in political things. But I could also see where that would just be something that would just destroy you.
Well, unfortunately, the people who got most activated were the most violent.
At least
in 68. Most radical.
At least at the
Democratic
convention. In 69.
I mean, you know, I knew one guy who went into the Weathermen. You know, and they made the decision, like, let's blow up some buildings. So, I mean, there was a real split between what I call the political left and the cultural left. And the cultural left was Woodstock, right?
Right.
The notion that hippies turn on, tune in, drop out, you know, go get 300,000 people in a cow pasture in upstate New York and close the New York Thruway because there are too many people who have abandoned their cars at the exit. You know, I mean, that was like a shock to the system. But I think, look, it's a mistake that we left politics because we got Richard Nixon. You know, in the sense that a lot of people just said, screw it, I'm not going to vote. And I'm not going to vote for Hubert Humphrey, and I'm not going to vote for Richard Nixon. I'm just not going to vote. And that, of course, ended up giving us Nixon.
Well, so it doesn't sound like you got out of politics. You just became less of a full-time avocation, and rock and roll became more of your
main. Yeah, I didn't become a conservative, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But it did, rock and roll became my business and my life.
So how did it go from the coffee house to working on a jug band to working with Bob Dylan?
So Albert Grossman kind of took a liking to me. And so I kind of moved up to the more important groups, Janis Joplin, then the band. And the band was this amazing group that had backed Bob in 65 and 66 while I was still in college, had been his backup band, and they were known as Levon and the Hawks then. And then they all moved up to Woodstock, and they got this funky old house called Big Pink, and they put a recording studio in the basement, And Bob started coming over, recording new songs. And out of that, the band started to believe they could do their own music that was in this kind of tradition of what we now call Americana, you know? I mean, and it's music that's been recorded in this studio a lot. It's kind of rootsy and
sort of country rock.
Yeah, and they made, you know, music from Big Pink, you know? And it was, The Wait is probably the most famous song from that time. And so I began to get very close to them, and then they said they were going to go on the road, and they said, would you be our tour manager? And I was graduating from Princeton, so I then, that became my full-time job, and I moved to Woodstock and got a house, and, you know, we started touring all through that summer, and then by August, we went to the Woodstock Festival, and that was a pretty stunning thing just by itself.
Where were you during Woodstock?
Well, the band was to play on the Sunday night, the closing night of the Woodstock Festival. We lived in Woodstock. The Woodstock Festival was not actually in Woodstock. It was like 50 miles south. And so when I woke up on Saturday morning, the New York Times had this, like, it was like chaotic. Showed the New York Thruway being shut down. It showed 300,000 people in this pasture, and it assumed that there was no food and there was no sanitation. It was going to be a complete mess. So I called down to Michael Lang, who was the promoter, and I said, Michael, what is going on here? And he says, oh, it's groovy, man. The hog farm is feeding everybody, and the doctors and nurses have set up these tents for people who've taken too much LSD, and we're dealing with it. He says, there's only one problem. You're not going to be able to get here from Woodstock. He says, so I'm sending a helicopter to pick you and the band up on Sunday afternoon. And so I had the biggest backyard, and so the helicopter landed in my backyard. We all got in the helicopter, and we flew, and about 20 minutes into the flight, we come over this ridge, and you look down at this pasture of 300,000 people dancing to Sly and the Family Stone, and you could hear the music from the helicopter. The guy opened the window a little bit, and it was biblical. It was like Cecil B. DeMille movie, you know? I'd never seen so many people in one place so crammed together. And we landed, and then it started raining, and, you know, it was crazy. But it was amazing, and nobody got hurt, unlike Altamont or anything else, and it was pretty cool in a way.
Listening to you speak is incredible. It's like being backstage to history.
Right.
The people you talk about, the iconic characters that you mention, having these casual conversations with, even just your view of Woodstock, right, that started out as seemingly what was going to unfold as a disaster and became a defining moment for American history. It's incredible, literally listening to you and feeling like, you know, you're backstage to history. What an incredible perch.
Yeah, I was lucky. I mean,
did you know
I happened
it was unfolding
to be
that way?
In the right place at the right time a lot of times in my life.
But when you were young, did you have a sense that I'm here and this is unfolding and I'm a witness to this? Or was it sort of what was happening?
No, I could sense that was a huge event.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense that many people showing up out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Nobody had any sense that it was going to be that big.
And it was just to hear rock and roll music.
Right.
I do think
that Madison Avenue took note because when I was growing up in the 50s, all the products were advertised for adults, right? The car ads had sophisticated 45-year-old men in
cigarettes.
Nice suits, and everything was advertised for adults. There was no advertising aimed at young people at all.
Yeah. And this changed that.
And all of a sudden you have, what the hell is going on here?
Right.
And you, all of a sudden, advertising switched. It became the Pepsi generation. It became the Woodstock Nation. Wow. It became Volkswagen is trying to sell that ugly boxy van as the hippest car in the world. You know, you can go camping. Yeah, everything yeah. switched.
Amazingly good point. You know, you're right.
Because people started selling sneakers.
Changed. Yeah.
You know, I mean, they didn't sell sneakers on... And bell bottoms. Life magazine, and you know, I mean, they didn't sell jeans that way.
I guess part of my question was, you know, as you could see it unfold, you know, the music that you were involved in had a message, right? It was impacting the world that we lived in. And I guess really my broader question was, could you sort of tell that you were at a moment that was defining how history would unfold? And the reason I ask is because if you look today, there's music that's new. Right. There's a genre of music that's definitely new. Older people have a tough time listening to it, but it certainly does seem to have a message and it resonates with young people. And it seems to want to take us in a different direction. Now, I don't know if every generation has this, but to me, it feels like, as you're saying about the late 60s, music today seems to have an impact on our political dynamic and the direction that young people at least tend to look politically.
I think music has less of an impact today than it did. I mean, I'll tell you that I think that the notion of the impact the Beatles had in the 60s, the impact the Rolling Stones had in the 60s, the impact that Bob Dylan had was the most important cultural thing that was going on right now. And I would say, I would be hard put to say that Taylor Swift or Adele or Jay-Z or Beyonce have that kind of impact. Mm. In fact, I would say that television has more, you know, TV drama has more impact culturally today than music does. And that's a good thing and a bad thing, because the music of the early 60s that we were talking about was very aspirational.
Yeah.
The times they are a-changing. The answer is blowing in the wind. Yeah. We shall overcome. But if you think about the TV dramas that have influenced our lives since 9/11, 20 years ago, it's Sopranos, Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Succession. These are all basically dramas about very corrupt people fighting for power in a very corrupt world. And to me, there's a kind of nihilism implicit in almost every TV drama up till Ted Lasso, yeah, that exists, you know? And, you know, we used to call them anti-heroes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in the 50s, there was a genre called film noir, in which the detective was always a cynical bad guy fighting in a corrupt world and everything. And you know, Double Indemnity, okay, let's kill the husband and get the insurance money. You know, right, that was the plot, right?
Right.
So I think that has an effect on society. You know,
yeah,
I
mean, interesting.
I would,
right.
I would argue even that the 2002, say when The Wire came out, mm-hmm, till 2016, that constant diet of drama about corrupt people,
right,
leads you ultimately to a place where we say, some people say at least, well, maybe we should get Tony Soprano to be the president, you know, which is what happened.
And, you know, because you and I are about the same age and Miriam is substantially younger.
Light years.
Light years younger. I had the same feeling because I was on the West Coast, you were on the East Coast, but I was activated by the music. I mean, everywhere we went, there was music that inspired us to get involved, to protest, to take action. And I mean, you listed some of the songs. We could go on and on about all the countless songs that were inspiring for people of our generation. And I don't see that kind of same music now. It may be, you know, it's not just that it's a different genre of music. It's just there's no cause. There's no issue. And one of the reasons why, cynically, why I think our generation was so active, especially because the Vietnam War, which is different now, is because we had the draft. So we were fighting not just for the good fight of Save the People of Vietnam and all that other stuff. We were fighting for our lives.
Totally.
Now that we have a professional military, our students of this era, they'll protest a little bit, but they're not shutting down buildings. They're not, you know, sitting in at the university, at Columbia University and other places, Berkeley, all over. And I think a lot of it has to do that it had less immediate impact on them.
I totally agree. And quite frankly, if you really look at the procession of military budgets, they keep going up year after year after year. I mean, we stopped fighting the Soviet Union in 1989, and we continue to have spend more and more money on the military, and somehow it's just like out of sight. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly out of mind for those kids that I've taught at USC in the last few years. They don't see any chance in the world that they would ever go in the military, and they don't have to. But as you noted, that was top of mind when you were a senior in college. You knew the next thing could be you're in some jungle.
We worried about what went until we got our draft number, where that put us, and then what were the options, like you're talking about, go to Canada, you know, cut off a finger, whatever it was. There were lots of horrible choices, which the kids nowadays, I mean, it's good and it's bad. I'm glad that all those kids don't have to worry about it. But I also feel they've been more lackadaisical because it's not so immediate.
So, well, the involvements that we have across the globe, if what you guys are saying is correct, and you're right, I don't know how it felt back. A, I didn't live in the States yet, but B, I wouldn't know how it felt. But I do think that it does make our foreign involvements less urgent for the American population, but also for young people. And I will agree that lyrics back then seemed to have a lot more meaning. It seemed like someone had sat down, wanted to tell a story, weaved lyrics that could rhyme in some way into a melody that would be pleasing. I don't think that happens at all right now. It's just words that jumble out with some sort of rhythm, whether it works or not is the luck of the draw. I do think there is a problem with the fact that the American population doesn't feel that same urgency about being involved somewhere else. And you're right, it is sort of distant, and that budget keeps growing and it's distant. You were talking about, TV or like audiovisual productions. Obviously, we don't just consume television now. But a lot of the shows that seem to meet with success have to do with this broader fight for terrorism or this like protection of our way of life and stuff. And again, I think it's kind of now it's kind of storytelling and it's lyrical and it's in the background and it doesn't have that immediate sort of this impacts us here kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, look.
And entertainment is now just entertainment.
Not to get too far off the ground, but we did spend $6.2 trillion, according to the Wall Street Journal, in the Mideast since the year 2001. You know, we might have spent that more wisely here.
You'd think.
Making
much more wisely. Yeah, I mean, we go in and we toppled Saddam Hussein, and then ISIS comes in, takes over, and the Shias are running Iraq now, and but that's...
And just for the historical marker, we're on the heels of a hasty withdrawal out of Afghanistan, where we spent three of those $6 trillion. So, obviously it was not an immediate or any kind of an urgent issue for Americans to want to address. But yeah, I now agree with you. I think that music was back then much more of a way
I agree
to connect.
Too. So... I don't want to lose track of your life, and I'm always between Miriam and I'm always the one that says, "Let's get back on track." And so you start working for Bob Dylan, you start working for the band, and where does that lead you?
So, we went to England in 69, in August, late August, to do a concert called the Isle of Wight. It was a music festival.
I remember.
And Bob was the headline act, Bob and the band. And so we were there the night before the concert, and this car, Daimler Benz, drives up, and this guy gets out in a really beautiful suit, and he says, "The Beatles will be here in 15 minutes. And he goes out and he puts this cross on the back of the yard for a helicopter landing sign. And sure enough, just like in Hard Day's Night, this helicopter lands and out jumps John, George, and Ringo and their wives. Mm-hmm. Paul had just had a baby and Linda had just had a baby, so they didn't come. But three of the Beatles showed up with their wives, and we had a wonderful dinner and then went out and played some music. And it was just very joyful. And over the course of 2 days, I kind of got to know George Harrison a little bit. And so when the thing was all over and the Beatles had sat in the front row with the concert and everything, and it was...
Somebody got them front row seats?
Yes.
They were lucky.
Huh? And... So when it was over, George said, "Well, would you like to come hang out at my house called Friar Park," which was this big, huge mansion he had that had been designed by the Queen Victoria's gardener. And it had all these weird little, he had a kind of trompe d'oeil of the Matterhorn. So you would sit in this little cupola, and you would swear you were looking at the Matterhorn, and it had powdered chalk on it. And because of the perspective, it looked like this giant mountain. It was like 150 feet high, right? You know, and it was all these other kind of trippy things. And the guy was an opium eater, so the Queen Victoria's gardener.
Oh,
so it had been built in the 18...
I thought you meant George was.
It had been built in the 1890s, right? Okay. So anyway... So then George starts coming to Woodstock, and in 71, he was staying at my house in Woodstock, and he said, "Ravi Shankar has called me, and he said, there's this place, Bangladesh, and it's like all the perils of Job are being dumped on it. It's got typhoons, it's got starvation, it's got... hunger, it's got cholera, it's got everything bad is going on, and nobody is paying any attention." And so he said, "Let's do a benefit concert and call it the Concert for Bangladesh." And people will begin to say, "Well, what's Bangladesh?" So I called down to Alan Klein, who was his manager, and he booked Madison Square Garden for August 1, 1971. And then George started putting a band together, which was Ringo and Klaus Voormann and, you know, Billy Preston and Leon Russell and Eric Clapton, this amazing band. And then he talked Bob Dylan into being on the concert. And so, bang, we had this amazing concert, which sold out two shows in like 25 minutes. And... it went off brilliantly, with one exception, which was that Eric Clapton turned out to be a junkie. And so he arrived.
He's since acknowledged that and apparently gotten clean and turned his life around.
And he's actually doing more to help
music addicts
than anybody in the country.
Right.
So why was that a monkey wrench?
So... he shows up in New York, and like any junkie in a place he's never been in, all he wants is to find a connection. And that just caused total chaos, everything. And eventually somebody showed up. I don't know how he found it, but anyway. Huh. But so we kind of had to nursemaid him through this two-day thing to get him on stage, and he notes, for instance, that he was so out of it that he was supposed to play the solo on My Guitar Gently Weeps, and he picked up the wrong guitar. He picked up this huge Gretsch wide body guitar when he needed a Fender Telecaster. You know, he did a lot of stupid things, just not being totally present. But we got through it, and it was great. So then...
Another moment where you put us behind the scenes of something huge.
How much money was raised for Bangladesh? Take out all the costs and all that. How much actual money was raised?
Up till now, it's about $35 million.
Wow.
All given to UNICEF. And that's from the record, the video, the movie, all the other things. So that was pretty good.
Yeah, that's an incredible amount of money, plus all the awareness it raised,
that's
right?
The main thing. People now know. The awareness. Yeah. People knew what Bangladesh was at the end of August.
And $35 million back then is like, I don't know what that's worth now. Yeah. That's a huge amount of money.
And basically, UNICEF really did great stuff in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
And, you know, quite frankly, if you look at a lot of labels in your clothing, you'll notice they're made in Bangladesh now.
You know, they now host a refugee crisis, right? The Rohingya flee to Bangladesh. I mean, it remains sort of a poor country with a lot of issues, but money and sweat and toil was spent, way more together than it was.
Yeah,
absolutely, I think much better.
It's one of those countries that has somehow survived compared to a lot of others that are, you know, barely hanging on by threads.
Right. And you're right, we do outsource some stuff there, and it does help their economy.
So, because that was such a success, that concert, George happened to be talking to Mick Jagger and bragging about it. And then I get a call from the Rolling Stones saying, would you come to the south of France to audition to be the tour manager for the Exile on Main Street tour? So I thought, well, that's interesting. And because Bob Dylan didn't want a tour, George didn't want a tour, the band wasn't really touring much.
It was time.
I didn't really have any other interesting options. So I took the ticket and went to Nice and then went to this villa in Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat.
So you're sitting there and your current gig is basically over. You're sitting there and thinking, what should I do? And then Mick Jagger calls?
Yeah.
It was as simple as that? Out of the blue?
Yeah.
Wow.
So note here on Saint-Jean-Cap-Ferrat, we had, remember, just to say, full circle here in the Palisades, we had a guest not long ago who had actually miraculously grown up in Saint-Jean. That was like 2 weeks before I was flying out to show that place to my children because it had a connection with me and my husband's life. But yes, she had, you know, she had been a baby. They had been sitting with her parents, I don't know, having coffee somewhere in Cannes, I guess, or Nice. And, you know, they looked over and they said, that's where we want to live. And she literally grew up there. So we'll have to introduce you.
So Keith had rented this amazing villa there right on the water. And so I show up for
Keith
a 1
Richards.
O'clock meeting, and there's nobody there, you know, except the butler. So he lets me in and gives me a croissant and some coffee, and I go out on the porch and watch the yachts kind of going around in the bay. And by 3 o'clock, Charlie Watts shows up. He's the responsible one. Dear departed Charlie
Watts.
Just died last week.
Yeah.
And by 5 o'clock, Mick shows up and pretends that the meeting was at 5 when it was at 1. But it doesn't matter. I'm fine. I'm kind of jet lagged and I'm just going with the flow. And so we begin the conversation, but I notice that about every 15 minutes, he calls the butler over and says, would you go get Mr. Richards out of bed?
Speaking of junkies.
Yeah, Keith Richards, right? And eventually around 7 p.m., Keith Richards comes down looking like 10 miles of bad road, scratching his neck.
Oh my.
And all these signs of junkie alert are going like, and I had thought to myself, as I'm trying to, on one hand, I'm trying to sell myself, and on the other hand, I'm thinking, well, I'm not so sure I want this gig. And I thought, look, it was hard enough getting Eric Clapton on stage once. This is a gig that's going to go on for 9 weeks, and there's four shows a week. I mean, this is the life's too short category. So the next morning, I told Joe Bergman, who was their kind of major domo, I said, you haven't offered me the job yet, but I'm going to just withdraw myself from consideration. I just can't really deal with this. And she said, okay, I understand. So I went home, back to L.A., and about 2 months later, Mick's secretary calls me and says, can you come up? Mick's rented a house in Bel Air. Can you come up and give him some ideas about album covers? Because he loves these album covers you've done with the band. And he's kind of stuck. So I'm going out the door, and I pick up this book called The Americans by Robert Frank, who was a Swiss photographer who had made a road trip across the country in 1955 and taken these stunning black and white street photos. And it's one of the most amazing books you've ever seen of photography. And so I bring it up to Mick, and I said, look, everyone knows what the Rolling Stones look like. You don't need your picture on the cover. Why don't you just put one of these pictures in? And there was this picture of this guy standing next to a jukebox in this really funky bar. And all the light is just coming from the jukebox, the only lighting of the thing. And it's a stunning picture. And I said, put this on the cover. It's Exile on Main Street. It's just, it's perfect. And he starts flipping through the book, and he's just like, oh, wow, 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 these are amazing. And he says, let's get this guy to take our picture. And I said, well, that's not the idea. These were taken in 1955. I don't even know if this guy is still alive.
Right.
He said, well, if he is alive, you put the word out that the Rolling Stones have paid $20,000 for him to take one picture. I promise you he'll show up. Which turned out to be true. So I go back to my house. The next morning, I call to New York. I find he was on welfare in New York, but he's now left, and he lives with his daughter in Mabou, Nova Scotia. So, and this is February, so I call around, and I actually find out there's a party line central operator in Mabou, Nova Scotia. That's how old-fashioned it is.
Crazy.
Like, she plugs you into, and I say, well, I want to speak to Mr. Frank. She says, well, that's impossible. And I said, why? And she said, well, there were a bad storm last week, and all the telephone wires are down. And I said, well, when will he be back up? She said, well, in a couple of months when the storm stopped. And I said, well, that's not going to do. And she says, well, his daughter comes into the general store once a week for supplies, so you could leave a message for her there. So she puts me through to the general store, and it just turns out she's there. So once I convince her it's not some kind of prank, and there actually is a $20,000 check for her father
end.
If he can get himself to L.A. with a camera, she said, okay, he'll call you tomorrow, collect. And so I get him. He says, I don't have a camera. I haven't had a camera for years. And I said, well, he says, I'll go to New York. I'll get a camera. So he goes down to New York. I fly him to L.A., first class. He gets off the plane, and he's this little short guy, and he's got a Super 8 movie camera. And he just keeps shooting. It's like 10, 15-second bursts of Super 8 everywhere. And I take him up to Mick's house that night. He regales Mick with these stories of beatniks and Allen Ginsberg and all these people he'd made movies about, and Jack Kerouac, and Mick is just entranced. And always Robert's taking these little snippets of Super 8 movies. And one night I see him rummaging through Mick's wastebasket and pulling stuff and putting it in his pockets. And I thought, what's going on here? So eventually the manager, Marshall Chess, starts flipping out and says, this guy's costing me, you know, $900 a night at the Beverly Hills Hotel for this bungalow we put him in. Let's get him to take a picture. So I say, Robert, you got to take a picture. And he said, well, I don't have a camera. I thought you got a camera in the yard. No. So I go to Bel Air Camera and Westwood, rent him a camera. He gets everybody to go down to the Grand Central Market downtown. This was his setting. He wanted a real funky place.
The Rolling Stones were going to Grand Central Market?
Right.
At a time they were open? The market was open?
Yeah. It was like, supposedly, we're all going to get there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, right? You want some kind of golden light. Yeah. This is February, right? So needless to say, Keith Richards doesn't show up till 4:15.
No golden light.
And the light is fading fast. It's almost dark. Robert has no lights. He gets about three pictures. And the manager just flips out, says, he is going home on the plane tomorrow. Screw this. This is amateur hour. And so Mick says, okay, you can send him home, but pay him the $20,000. And the manager said, for what? And he says, for just who he is. Yeah. I thought, whoa, that's pretty cool. So I take him to the airport. I give him the check for $20,000. He goes home. I thought, well, that was a bust. 2 weeks later, the entire album cover of Exile on Main Street shows up in the mail. And what he had done is he'd made a kind of Robert Rauschenberg collage of these little strips of Super 8 film, old pictures that he'd taken from the Americans, little scraps of paper that Mick had written lyrics on, and all this. And it's brilliant. And it won the Grammy for best album cover of the year, you know, and Mick, of course, was so overjoyed by this and proved to his manager that he was right and the manager was wrong, that he convinced the manager to pay Robert to make a movie of the tour.
Oh, wow. And what an amazing story.
And this is, of course, the notorious Cocksucker Blues, which then the Rolling Stones had to pay millions of dollars to make sure nobody ever got to see.
I was thinking, I haven't heard of that. It's the only thing I haven't heard of that you've talked about, the Cocksucker Blues.
Yes. But Robert's career was totally revived. He had exhibitions at the Museum of Modern Art. Everything went right for him. He lived out the rest of his life.
What an incredible story. You were walking out the door, just grabbed a book, and that sort of led to this chain of events.
They reissued the Americans. It was amazing.
And those scripts of paper from the trash were just
part
notes
of the album?
Lyrics that he'd thrown away.
Yeah.
Part of the album cover. That is truly amazing.
Wow. Amazing.
You're a walking piece of American history. So at the Annenberg, you want to go?
Well, no, I could listen to John talk all day, but he's done other things with his life too, and I don't want to sell him or his book short.
So before you go there, I was curious. Tell us a little about, teaching the next generation, and you had the Innovation Lab, the Annenberg Innovation Lab at USC. What is that? I mean, so I've seen innovation departments in like the city or here and there. They're all different. But what is it when you're sort of heading it?
Good segue, Miriam.
Well, the idea was that the convergence of big tech and entertainment was going to be messy. Mm. And that somebody had to try and mitigate between Southern California and Northern California, be a place where they could meet, talk about what was happening, you know? And I'm not saying that we figured it all out, but we did early on note that, for instance, the internet was not going to be necessarily a boon to the musicians who work in studios like this. That the fact that YouTube could put any tune on YouTube for free, right, and the musicians wouldn't get paid was not going to be helpful to musicians. Mm. And so, you know, the problem, of course, with big social media companies is that the government gave them a free pass called Safe Harbor, two laws in which you cannot sue Facebook for anything that's on their service. They purported to be not in control of anything that is on their service. Now, that, of course, is a total lie. They spend millions of dollars blocking pornography, blocking jihadist videos, all sorts of things that might make their advertisers angry. But they don't block music that musicians don't want on their service. Mm-hmm. They don't block lies about vaccination. Mm-hmm. They don't block lies about president, you know, voting machine companies switching votes from Trump to Biden. And so, whereas Dominion Voting Machine Company can sue Fox News, right, for lying about that, they can't sue Facebook, which has far more power than Fox News. I mean, Tucker Carlson, if he's lucky, gets 2 million people a night. But he gets, over the course of a month, about 100 million views on Facebook or YouTube. So, you know, so that's the Innovation Lab was an attempt to try and think, and, you know, and out of that came a book that I wrote called Move Fast and Break Things, which was about how Facebook, Google, and Amazon cornered culture and undermined democracy. And at the time, that was a very controversial statement. This was in 2016. Mm. Now it's not so controversial. But, you know, young people, to answer your question in a kind of roundabout way, it's hard to convince them, for instance, that putting their whole lives online is not necessarily a good thing. Right. It's hard to convince them that privacy is actually a good thing to have. So, I mean, in some ways, you're spitting into the wind, you know, when you're objecting to Facebook or Twitter or YouTube. But I think to some extent, we've had some effect in the regulation field, and people are beginning to think about how we can regulate them. And maybe that safe harbor should be
Modified withdrawn in some way.
So that they'd have to accept the fact that they are publishing organizations, just like every other publisher has to deal with that. And so they have to be more careful about what they publish.
Well, I think you've also had an impact on public opinion, not only on legislation, but I think on public opinion. You know, slowly this idea has caught on that we need to monitor or at least be a little bit more aware of the impact that Facebook has, what it does with our profiles, the information we put up there, what kind of narrative seed it puts out into, you know, into the American discourse and how that sort of takes off. I think you have had a huge impact. But I think part of it is also that Facebook probably has evolved since its early days when it got that safe harbor. You know, I don't think in the early days of Facebook anybody thought that this many millions of people around the globe would be using it, not just to put information out, but to get information.
It's almost,
and so for that reason,
4 billion people are on Facebook.
And so it is very influential. That's interesting.
And by the way,
that is spitting against the wind, probably.
Just to make you completely crazy, I mean, Mr. Zuckerberg's next idea is something called the metaverse, in which you are going to live in a virtual world where you're going to spend half your day with a helmet on, living in meetings virtual meetings in which it's not your face, but your avatar mm-hmm. of your face being presented to other people. And it's all going to seem like you're all in the same room, but it's only, I mean, the first version of you don't even have legs. You're just kind of an embodied upper body. I don't know that I want to spend my life in the metaverse. And though Mr. Zuckerberg seems to think that not only will you be there, you will be there a lot. And that's by the terrible. Way, you can't look away from the ads that will be there in the background of everything. And
really?
Yeah.
This sounds terrible.
Well, don't you think the fact that all of the heads of big tech companies have been called before Congress to testify at least maybe slows the train a little bit to make them think that Congress is looking at it, the government, if they keep pushing and pushing and pushing, some laws are going to come down that they're not going to like.
Okay, so I don't know if you read the Wall Street Journal or go online with, say, Axios or anything like that, but you'll notice there's an ad from Facebook once a day telling you how wonderful they are, and also that they're willing to change some, willing to cede to some internet thing. They just want to control what the legislative process is. In other words, they're spending millions of dollars lobbying to make sure that they don't get told what to do. They have a lot of say in whatever changes are going to come. I mean, look, they have too much power. Yeah. It's very clear to me. And
they have a lot of money to keep that power.
They have more money than any corporations. Yeah. I mean, between, say, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple, that's probably about $4 trillion of cash just sitting on their balance sheet.
That's worth a lot of influence.
$4 trillion
in legislation. I have to say, it's interesting that you see that ad because I do go on Wall Street Journal and Axios and plenty of others, and I don't ever see that ad. So there must be some algorithm that identifies that you're the person to see
that
ad.
That's even worse. Even
worse. They're targeting you.
Undoubtedly.
They're targeting me.
Oh my gosh. Your past has caught up with you. They know who you are.
So at Annenberg, you're sort of making a new generation of people aware of this. So
hopefully.
Assuming
I'm what's called emeritus now.
Means you're old.
I like you. I'm 90% retired. I write books, and I sit on the board of the Innovation Lab. And I sit on the board of the Authors Guild, and I sit on the board of the Americana Music Association, and that's my life, other than writing books.
So you get to kibitz, you get
input. I don't have to listen to students complaining that they didn't get an A.
Yeah. But you have input into the direction.
Which
it
is
goes.
A nice thing, because I used to teach law as well. Yeah. And
but I assume that these are kids, even if you're not teaching them, you're influencing the way it's taught. And I just want to say these are probably people, little human beings, who've never experienced life without their phone or some sort of electronics having a huge impact on their day, on their trajectory, on their future. And so I assume the Innovation Lab is asking them to rethink that a little bit.
Yes. You know, when I would ask my students, how long could you go without your phone? It would go anywhere from 1 hour to maybe 5 hours.
Maybe.
But the idea of going 3 or 4 days without it was just out of the question. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're all tied to them. I mean,
yeah, and I
ask my wife. She'll tell you I've got mine at my hip, and you know, I'm uncomfortable if
without
I don't have it nearby.
Yeah.
Because there might be some useless shit that I didn't know about, and I got to find out.
Or your Pally Podcast co-host might need you on a dime. It's important.
Right.
Tell us about your Palisadian life. How long have you lived in the Palisades?
23 years.
What part?
We live at the top of Charmel Lane.
Okay.
So what I guess is called Marquez Knowles, but it's
you're a stone's
so you're
throw
the
from
street
Merriam.
Yeah, and you're the street that county fire shows up at every time they think there's going to be something threatening the area.
My house was the command post for the last big
fire. The Palisades fire.
The one that came up from Palisades Drive.
Yeah.
So Charmel Lane is apparently their border. Like once Charmel is in danger, that's when they look at...
Thank God. I give the fire department foundation... a good bit of money because they saved my house. I mean, it came, the trees in the front of our yard were all singed, but it didn't hit the house. As we were pulling out of our driveway with my wife's and my car and our best friend's car filled with my photography collection, the guys pulling the hose up the driveway saying, "Don't worry, sir, we'll save your house." And they essentially camped out in our lower yard for 3 days. And amazing. Once we could come back, I would bring them eggs and bacon every morning and coffee because they could see everything from our amazing. Yard. Because we're right on the edge.
I live in the Highlands, so we saw the fire from, you know, a couple miles up Palisades Drive.
Yeah.
And we were ready to get out, but... The wind turned in your direction, not ours. So we didn't have to, but we're all living in a precarious area.
Right.
I mean,
it's
scary. We think of it as different neighborhoods, but it's really just one mountain.
But you know,
I
mean, it's a great town.
It is a wonderful place to be.
And I often think that you know, local community is what life is really about. That's why I don't think so much about national politics so much anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I think we all are here because we love so much about the Palisades, which is why Merriam and I do this podcast, because it's an opportunity for us to meet and spend some time with interesting, dynamic, creative people like yourself. And I see that our time is almost up. And I can't tell you what a delight it is because, like I said, we're the same generation. You got to see all those things from close up. I read about them. I listened to them on what was the radio back then. And it's just fascinating to hear your insights and to spend some time with you. I really appreciate it.
By the Magic Years.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. The Magic Years by Jonathan Taplin, Scenes from a Rock and Roll Life. It's a great book, and today hopefully gave our listeners a little bit of a taste of what's lurking in this book, which is utterly fascinating.
Yeah, it really was a pleasure to have you. It was a pleasure to listen to you. I have a feeling we could do it for hours and hours and hours. So thank you for making the time to come, and it's great to know that we live in this town with exactly what Steve said, dynamic, interesting people like you who've seen a whole lot of American history.
Well,
thank you.
Totally fun to be here.
Great.
With both of you.
Glad to have you. And this is like home for you. I know you're the only guest we've ever had who's spent a lot of time here at Village
Studios.
This very studio.
Thanks once
again. Very lovely
John.
Having you.
Okay.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Great.